Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of Angel Insights, where we hear from some of the top performing business angels in the UK and the entrepreneurs behind some of their portfolio companies. I'm your host, Tom Britton, co-founder of Syndicate Room, creators of the Access EIS Fund, which uses data to identify some of the top performing angels in the UK and builds a fund that co-invests with these angels. But enough about me, let's get to the show. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Calley, who's founded and run 14 businesses in technology, property, and publishing over the last 40 years, and has also become one of the most successful angel investors in the UK. He was previously the chair of Cambridge Angels, the president of the European Business Angel Network, a fellow in entrepreneurship at the Judge Management School, a mentor to hundreds of founders, including myself, and he's the author of two books related to angel investing. So I'm sure we're going to get a lot of useful insights out of Peter. Peter, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's great. Great to be. I've known you for so many years now. It's really great. And we've become friends, haven't we, over time?
Yeah. And actually, you were mentioning it earlier. You were on the show many years ago when it was a different business and a different host.
Peter, welcome to Angel Insights. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Harry.
Harry Stebbings, who's obviously gone on to do interesting things. Anyways, it is a pleasure. And I wanted to talk a little bit before we go into angel investing about what you did before angel investing, because you actually spent a lot of time in industry, but also in founding your own businesses. So start off, tell us a little bit more about that, and then we'll talk about angel later.
Yeah, so I've been in angel investing about probably 14 years or something like that. So I'm 65, so that's 51. Left uni at 21, so I've got, yeah, 3 decades of experience before that. So I did computer science and engineering uni a long time ago, worked in corporate life for 2 or 3 years for a company called Logica in London and in Wales and in Bath, actually. I decided to have a change. So I moved out to Germany. So I joined a small company, which is a supplier to a brewery that we were automating in South Wales. I was their software department, the whole software department.
You were the team.
Exactly. And then after about a year, it got sold to a big German corporate called Heckler & Koch. And two of us didn't want to do that. So we set up on our own. So we set up a competitive company back in early 1981 and built that. So I ran the whole tech department, including hardware, software, and set up international distribution. So I set up about a dozen distributors around Europe and one in the States. And then first kid born, who's 37 now, came back to the UK and set up Camdata, which I still have after 38 years.
Amazing.
I'm sitting in my home office, as we all are nowadays, and in the converted shower room next to me is a little workshop where I get a soldering iron out and do some repairs and things. Camdata's had a funny old journey, got up to about 30 people who went bust in 91, and I resurrected it. So learned a lot from that, ups and downs, didn't take any external finance. And then I got in, lots happened, and then I got into property development. So I built some houses, and that's how I built up the capital in order to start angel investing. Moved back to Cambridge about 18 years ago now, involved in sales and marketing and lots of charitable work. I was 16 years old, I was on the board of 7 different charities in 3 different sectors. To come on to angel investing, it was in about 06. I was mentoring a guy who'd done the same course here in Cambridge as I had, computer science, and invested some money into him. Now, it wasn't really an angel investment in this. I was there on day one, so I was a bit like a financial co-founder. Anyway, we grew it. It was a service company, became a product company, and we sold it to a company here in Cambridge, a software company called Redgate, in about 08, 09. It was a 17x, as it turns out, which was good multiple after 2.5 years.
Amazing.
But I got 17,000 quid out of 1,000 quid, which is pretty good.
Not bad.
much more importantly, during those 2 years, 2.5 years, I learnt the word angel, what it meant. And I thought, yeah, I really quite like the idea of this, not being somebody who runs the business, but somebody sits on the sidelines and helps. And during that time, I'd got to know a guy called Robert Sampson, who was quite well known in Cambridge, who'd formed the Cambridge Angels, which actually is 20 years old. I formed Cambridge Angels with another guy called David Cleveley here in Cambridge. I asked if I could join and I was let in. And I've been membership secretary for 6 of the last 10 years and chair for 3 years. And I often say this, I wouldn't have let myself in. But most important thing is I learned how to angel invest from this group. This group has taught me basically everything I know. That was the transition into angel investing.
A lot to unpack there. So if we can backtrack for a second, you had set up, I think it was about 14 businesses in your own time. You know, what was it that drove you on to continually build these different businesses?
Well, in some cases, failures. So starting again. It certainly wasn't money. And in fact, I never made, compared with a lot of my friends here in the Cambridge Angels and other angels I know, I haven't had the big exit. I wanted independence. I wanted control of my own life. I wanted to sort of make a change. That sounds a bit grand, but I really wanted to be my own boss. So that's really why I did it all those times. And the reason it's as many as 14 was just because I like a challenge. Yeah. Opportunities arose and I took them, basically. And some of them have been really successful, and some of the tech businesses have given me good lifestyles but have not been super successful. I seem to be wired to be an entrepreneur, basically.
I would agree with that. But there was one other thing that you said, though, about property development, and that the property development is what funded your ability to angel invest. Was that at the back of your mind? Like, okay, if I do this well and I have a bit of capital, what am I going to do with that capital next?
No, not at all. No, I've never planned that far forward. I did it because the opportunity was there. What had happened, I'd bought a house in Stamford and the garden had planning permission for 4 flats. I let that lapse. And then when I had another look at it, I converted into planning permission for 3 houses. And I had a couple more as a joint venture, and I'd done some refurb work, including a 13th century cottage, grade 2 style listed cottage. Ooh. Which I've only just used up the capital losses on that recently. So no, it was just enjoy, and an opportunity was there, and money came out of it.
Okay. And then coming on to your first angel investment, which at the time you didn't really know was an angel investment. Most of the people that we've talked to on the show would have said that their first investment was a loss. You said it yourself. You didn't put a whole lot in, but you got 17x on that. When that happened, was that a aha moment and like, I should just keep doing this? Or was it a I got lucky moment and maybe I need to think about how I approach it instead of just investing because it's a friend of mine?
It's neither of those quite, because that enabled me to go to one of the Cambridge Angels dinner and have a positive story, which then allowed me to join the organization. So that's when I started to see deals of various sorts. And in fact, my next angel investment, I invested in a company which I never should have invested in, a biotech company up in York. And the reason I'm so passionate, enjoy this so much, is because I spend time with the millennials. It rubs off on me, this passion of life and enjoyment and challenges and everything else. But the important thing is I've really enjoyed it.
No, I mean, and that definitely comes across in all of the conversations that we have. If you can think back to that first true angel investment in the biotech company, how did you approach that investment? And then we'll develop that into talk about how you approach investments now. So what was it about this company that made you think, oh, biotech, yeah, that sounds great, I'm going to get involved?
It was the beginnings of what is so important nowadays, which I lost for a few years and then regained, which is investing in people. So this was investing in a super good technical person with a really good backup person in finance and ops. So actually, I was investing in the people. You don't invest in plans. Plans with people is not the right way to do it. You invest in people with plans, because the plan won't be the thing that happens. So many unknowns. So it's understanding how to invest in people. And of course, people investing in people, which is trust and all kinds of other things, takes time to work out whether your people that you've got standing in front of you, you've got to know, are the right people to invest in. And I still, of course, get that wrong.
Yeah, you've made, I think it's 76 investments now. So
yes.
Clearly you've got some right, though. With the ones that have gone wrong, what were some of the lessons that you learned from them outside of, oh, it wasn't the right people?
Lots of bits and pieces. I mean, the product market fit. There's a big difference between investing in Europe and investing in the States. In the States, investors will go in on the basis of customers being found and working how to monetize. Whereas over here in Europe, likes to see that some sort of break even is available at some point. Because the problem is, if you haven't got a break even and the investment money dries up, where can you go? You can shrink, or you can exit, but you try and exit when you're in a hurry. Yeah. You can exit for not very much. But you don't have to worry about that if you've got to break even, basically. So there's a lot more pressure to get to break even. In most of these cases, it's because it hasn't got to break even and the investment's dried up. So that's the case of almost all of my failures.
With that focus on trying to break even, do you think that's restricting the company's thinking? They're focused narrowly on, we just need to do this, and that puts the blinkers on to bigger vision? Or what do you think it is?
Definitely that could be argued exactly that. I think, you know, at the end of the month, you've got to pay the bills. Where's that money coming from? It can potentially come from loans, but they have to be paid back. It can come from grants, of course, but they'll fizzle out in time. Generally, for a company, unless it's a service company that's generating income very soon, it's going to come from equity. It's going to come from shareholders. And you know, you've been on this journey a long time yourself. You fully understand that. If the shareholders aren't there to fund you, then you've got to rely on customers. So in the end, customer income is really important. I take the example of a drug discovery company. A drug discovery company cannot have customers on day one. It hasn't even worked out what the drug is, the molecule is, and it's got to go through regulatory processes and being trialed and everything. So it might take 10 years to get to that point. So it can't get to break even. You need the money from somewhere. So it's basically coming from investors until you get to the point you've either exited or you're getting from customers. And if that money dries up, then where's the company going, basically?
So on that basis, though, you talk about the US market versus the UK. And in the US, people think about moonshoots. You know, this could be huge or it's going to go bust rather quickly. Do you think that's a better approach necessarily than the UK kind of safe and steady towards break even? Or just is it just different and neither is better?
It's very different. It's obviously much, much, much riskier for all parties. It's riskier for the entrepreneur because they're so reliant on investors for surviving. Take WhatsApp as an example. It was a dollar a year at one point, remember that? And they still managed to keep 450 million customers apparently at that point. But 450 million dollars a year wasn't going to get them to break even apparently at that point. So no, it's a completely different mentality. But it would frighten me if I was to put money into a company that didn't have some core strong IP of some sort, which might include patents, that didn't really know when it was going to get enough customer income to break even, i.e. to cut the ties from the requirement for equity investors to carry on pumping cash in.
Yeah,
I think if anything, we're too cautious in Europe. But at the same time, the Americans have got some great advantages. They've got a massively bigger market than we have in the UK because Europe isn't really a common market for early stage companies. And the big one is they've got, and China will, I'm sure, catch up on this, they've got the exits. The exits tend to happen in the States much more easily. Obviously, the Americans do buy non-American companies, but they buy American companies more easily.
We could spend a lot of time picking apart the US and what's happening in China as well, but we'll focus on the UK and angel investing for now. So we talked about a few of the lessons that you've learned and the things that you've observed. You know, you mentioned it yourself, you've been investing as an angel for about 14 years now, and I'm sure that your investment approach has changed. So talk us through how you approach something now.
Yes, okay. So about 4 or 5 years ago, so I'm 65, I decided that the journeys I'm on, because they're deep tech B2B, tend to take, to get a good exit, you tend to sort of 10, 12, 15 years. So if I'm investing at 65, I might take for a good exit getting to 80, assuming I get to 80. I don't want to leave too much behind for my children. So that's the first point. Second point, it's very, very risky and one shouldn't be taking such high risks later in life. One should be enjoying the money one's acquired, giving it away or spending it or whatever, or giving away to the kids in time. And so actually having the very risky end of the asset allocation spectrum doesn't really make much sense. So I decided that I would stop investing at the age of 65. Now I've broken my rules already. I had to change the rule, which is now that I won't invest in anybody unless I've already been on an entrepreneurial journey with them. So I've made two investments since I was 65. So this means my portfolio over time will reduce. And so I'm actually going to go away for a couple of years when I can, away for a few months, say in Singapore or in Vancouver or in Sydney or something, and help the local ecosystem and study from that and do some touristy stuff like ski mountaineering or rafting. I will be traveling with somebody and we'll have a great time together, and she and I will be doing a bit of worky stuff and we'll be doing some real fun, adventurous stuff as well. I want to get the fun stuff done before things go downhill too far.
Don't want to get sentimental, but it is like seeing what you do now is just incredible. And all the things that you're involved with outside of the angel stuff is, I'll say, inspiring, and the fact that you're going to go off and continue to learn, but in a different phase of your life and a different type of learning is something that I hope to be able to do. Thanks for the motivation. But you did say one thing about you're breaking your rule on not investing, and now it's only investing in people you've been on a journey before. Does that also lend itself to follow-on rounds, or are you specifically looking at only new investment opportunities?
No, that's definitely includes following rounds. So I continue to support my portfolio with time and investment. Okay. I don't usually invest when the pre-money goes above 8 million because my 10, 20, 25, 30K chunks, because I tend to put smaller amounts in, but follow on above 8 million. If I put 20K in, it's not really, the valuation of 8 million doesn't going to make much difference. You know, they're going to burn that pretty quickly. And the uplift on that is going to be less by definition than it was on the early rounds. So one of my rules is I invest very early, pre-revenue almost certainly, and add as much value as I can. And that leads to the enjoyment bit. I mean, obviously, there's tears of pain as well as tears of joy. It's a tough life being an entrepreneur, and therefore that's reflected back on, to some extent, on the very involved shareholders.
Yeah, talking about that, like obviously you and I and Syndicate Room has been through ups and downs along the way and pivot and restructure and all of that. And you've always been one to be a good mentor, a good sounding board for things. When entrepreneurs are going through hardships and they're trying to figure things out and there's a lot of stress and tension, how do you help them deal with that?
Being a shoulder to cry on, and you know, men have cried on my shoulder, entrepreneurs, I've seen that more than once, when stuff has been really, really difficult as an entrepreneur, as a founder. The amount of help I give depends obviously on how invested in, not in terms of the cash, but invested in terms of, you know, connection with the business. And I haven't got time to be on 50 boards, clearly. As a shareholder, I'm on the same journey. So if somebody asks me a question, I will definitely help them do that. But in terms of the support I can give, I am available. You know, I'm pretty open character, you know, and I'm happy to share stuff, and I'm happy to receive that back again. And I hope the trust can be built up so that people will open up to me about personal circumstances if they want to talk about that. I'm not a counsellor, clearly. I'm not a psychotherapist, but I'm a, you know, a good ear, I hope.
There's definitely some angels who prefer to be like, here's my money, talk to me when you need my skill set. Do you think when you invest in someone in a team, because you've said it's all about people, do you kind of have to feel like that mutual wanting to work together has to be there from the start? Or is it okay if you just trust the company and the other investors that you don't have that bond necessarily?
Absolutely the former. And one of the mistakes was in the early days was to some of the latter. This American word coachable. If I'm deal leading, I will have worked that out as part of the due diligence process when I'm actually mentoring and helping the entrepreneurs. And nowadays, I wouldn't even invest if I felt they weren't coachable. And it's not coachable as in listening to me. It's listening to all the other stuff and information going on. It's listening to the market and the staff and the suppliers and regulators and all the rest of it. Because as a Syndicate Room did this massive pivot, didn't you, from crowdfunding to a fund manager.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's a huge. And so you as an organization have listened and pivoted. Many organizations pivot. But the only way you're going to do that is not to be over arrogant, and you've got to be focused and driven and everything, but you must also listen at the same time. So yes, to answer your question more directly, if these people are not willing to listen, then I'm unlikely to invest. And if they are willing to listen, I'm willing to help. And for the ones that I'm closer to, I'm helping the whole time. I'm on, at the moment, 9 boards of various sorts. And of course, even the ones I'm not on the board of, and I hope they know, they can reach out to me if they want some help. But the other very important one I must just add is this business of building up trust and being truthful. And that's for both parties. Because in the end, I as a human being am investing in you as a human being to use my money wisely and grow the business and be central with it. So it's trust in the founders to justify the valuation you're buying in at.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking about valuations just a little bit more, because you kind of hinted on it earlier, you won't invest if the valuation is above 8 million. And most of the time you're going in when it's sub 1 million.
Trying to, that around at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, as time goes on, they become less available.
It's gone up and because there's a lot of capital around. But there's lots of good entrepreneurs around as well. So there will be a correction, everybody expects. We'll wait and see when that happens or if it happens.
Yeah. Coming back to that though, so with potential exits for companies, because obviously in your portfolio, you've had an exit of over 100x, which is phenomenal. And you've had a few others that are tens of x's. You'd like to think that most founders think their company will be worth 100 million at least, or a billion. And not all companies will get to that. Do the companies have to exhibit a change your life type of exit? Or are you willing to get involved if you think something will be more change your car or change your house?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the exit quantum for me will depend on how much money I'm putting in, of course, won't it? So we talk about these house changing, et cetera. But if I put 100K in, I've written it off and it comes back again, I could buy a very good car or two cars, three cars, or I could buy a house in the city I grew up in, which is Hull, you know. So, but if I only put 10K into that and they got 10K out again, you know, it's a smallish second-hand car of some form. So actually basing on that isn't right, but that isn't quite your question. The question was, have they got the aspirations to grow big? And they have to have that. They shouldn't be driven by money though. My financial return is based on money. If somebody is just in it to make money, then they'll actually scare me off as an angel.
obviously every company wants to get big, but you'll have a limitation. And you know, people talk about, ooh, what's the market size? And we could be 5% of the market and it's a £1 billion market. And then that's huge, or you know, whatever the numbers are. But if you looked at a company and a solid company came to you where pre-money £1 million, and there was a clear way to exit at 10 million or 15 million, percentage-wise, that's a pretty big exit. But from a company's perspective, the fact that they're thinking about, oh, we could maybe get this to maybe a 15 or 20 million exit from the start, does that show a lack of ambition? Or do you think that's clarity? They know exactly how they're going to get that. And where's the trade-off?
That is lack of ambition. And because there'll be dilution on the way. So the magic 10x we all talk about, which is only a number, is just so that over a wide portfolio of companies, you'll end up with total return of your capital plus some sort of percentage. Now, if they would set out, just wanted to grow it to 20 million exit at a million valuation, that wouldn't be enough, or 2 million valuation or 3 million valuation. As it turns out, from data from Bowhurst, the average exit in the UK is sort of between 5 and 25 million.
Yeah.
There are not a great deal beyond that. If you look at all my exits, only one was north of 30 million pounds. Go in early. Not too much dilution. So exit occurs, or customer income occurs in, then you can get your multiples, but you don't need a 10x on all of them. You know, that would be super greedy, because like all things, it's the outliers, the 107x. It wasn't something that one should take in any way typical.
In looking at that, so it was a 30 million pound exit, right? When they set out, were they looking at trying to be 100 mil or a unicorn? Did they have that thought in their mind? And what was their plan? And why did they settle on 30?
The initial meetings, there was no concept of doing other than building a business. The exit, actually, which we're just talking about, was to a PE house, private equity house, and it gave liquidity, full liquidity to me and a bit of liquidity to the two founders, and one of them's still CEO and carrying on the journey. So it was only a secondary event. It wasn't a full trade sale. There aren't many of the investments, the exits I've had, that have gone for the 100 million or something that was driven purely by financial return. In the same way, when you joined Syndica Real, I don't think you were expecting to have a 100 or a billion exit, were you?
No.
You were joining a journey, weren't you? Yeah. And you'd like a good return at the end of it, as we all would, or all the investors would.
I'd just like to change my car. It would be all right now, but no, it's going all right. Let's move on to a few kind of quick fire questions, because I'm conscious of your time. I really do appreciate that. So first off, what's the best book or resource that you've read recently from any genre?
The two I'm reading at the moment, actually, are one is about the Nudge Unit, behind the Nudge Unit. A guy called David Halpern set up something which is to do with psychological behavior and altering the UK population. He was involved in at the beginning of COVID. That's really interesting to see the psychology behind making people change things. David Halpern happens to live in Cambridge. And the other one I'm reading is actually a very interesting book which is called Range. And I'm reading this just probably to confirm what I've think about myself. And the subtitle is How Generalists Triumph in a Specialized World. Because I am a generalist. It might seem like angel investor is a subset of investing, but generally over the last 12, 13, 14 years, I've probably seen 15,000 business plans. And I know a huge amount in terms of breadth and not much depth, not in biotech, but everything else about business models and tech and everything. So I'm extremely generalist in that respect. And so proving that being a generalist actually has value. So I'd probably just confirmation bias is the reason I'm reading it.
The ones that you're reading right now are interesting. And I think that's, you know, pulling from different industries or genre or whatnot is actually a key to keeping your generalist, but also being specialized nature, you know, because if you only read business books, it would, one, get boring, but you would start to see the same thing over and over again. And you couldn't really think outside of that box. Okay. So you've said you're a generalist. We've talked about that a little bit, but is there a tech trend that interests you the most right now?
Yeah, not in terms of investing, but in terms of personal interest. I'm really keen that I ensure that my health span, to come back to what I said, the time you want healthy, is as long as possible. So the sort of things that can help that, I'm wearing two wearables. So I've got a Fitbit one and I've got an Apple Watch and the other one. So, and I've got longitudinal data, health data, 20 years of cholesterol, and blood pressure and everything else, and my waist scales, Wi-Fi connected and everything. So building up longitudinal data and using that data in such a way, and there's a lot of this going on, and the data can be collected so you can make changes to your lifestyle. Taking control of one's own health and not leaving it to the system, basically. And I'm very keen on anything to do with that.
I had a good chat with someone who runs a longevity website about the different parts of longevity. And you've absolutely described one of it where it's useful lifespan
yes.
versus total lifespan. So next one, again, could have that in another episode. But I mean, you've been an entrepreneur for a long time and you've been investing for almost 15 years now. What keeps you so invested in what you're doing on the investing side?
It's spending time with passionate, driven, interesting people. And of course, that applies at all ages. But I kept younger in thought processes and you know, to some extent, my own health by spending time with younger people.
It's one of those kind of you are what you eat type of thing, or you are who you interact with. So you know, keep your own mentality that way and young and open to learning. Definitely benefits entrepreneurs and angels. Last question, with the benefit of hindsight, what's the one thing you would have liked to know when you were starting off angel investing that you now know?
It's people. It's just build the trust, the understanding, the way of analyzing is something that you can't easily teach angels. I tried to do that by writing the book, but realized actually until they've had the practice and the time, you know, even if they're psychologists or sociologists or whatever is their professional career, actually understanding what will make an entrepreneur successful or not is something that will attract me to investing in that person or not. And it's a bit, it's, some of them are obvious, like team dynamics. You can sort of observe quite easily how they'll cope with under pressure, et cetera, but it's just making sure that you invest in the people with a plan.
I think we did a survey with the angels 2 years ago. What do you invest in? Team came first on 70% of the response. You're like, okay, fair enough. And then the rest was all, everyone's second point was completely different. So the only thing everyone agreed on was team. Team and delivery. Delivery was generally quite high on it, but then beyond that, it was
so difficult, isn't it? Because you don't know what they're going to deliver, who they're going to deliver it to. You can't analyze that at the beginning at all, can you? So, and of course, just to say again, that if you're a newbie angel listening to this, it's really quite difficult to work out how to do this. And the sensible way to do it is to follow somebody else. And in the case with the fund, the Syndica Room Fund, you're following, if you invest in that, people like me who've done it before. But if you're doing it as a standalone angel, you've just got to hang around with people that have done it before, which is why an angel group, if you can find one and join it, makes so much sense.
So Peter, it has been a pleasure, but I want to leave the last word to you to remind people of where they can engage with you. So your website and your books, but thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. So petercowley.org, that's O-R-G, and then investedinvestor.com, which is the two books and 75 podcasts.
It's been a pleasure, and hope we can revisit this conversation in 12 months' time or so. So thank you, Peter. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Tom. Thank you.
You've been listening to Angel Insights, produced by Syndicate Room. Until next time, bye.